We now move to the panel session where we really pick up some of the issues that Hans covered and also move more broadly. I guess if we can just reflect a bit on what some of the things that Hans has said, I guess, Glenn, as Governor of the Reserve Bank, just starting with you, Hans has commented that Basel is really inadequate. He likened it to the credit rating agencies that really didn't get a good wrap-up in what happened with the crisis in his description of Basel and its role. What's your view on Basel and its work? And I'll then move around the panel on that issue.
Well, I'm, of course, not a supervisor, so I can speak with complete freedom about banking supervision matters, I suppose, therefore. I think it would be foolish to deny that the capital regulation and, for that matter, liquidity regulation, which is another big issue of this crisis. I think perhaps supervisory community spent a long time on capital, not quite enough on liquidity, and many have said that. So it would be foolish to deny that there are changes that ought to be made. I guess I would not be quite as critical as Hans was about Basel II per se, because it seems to me that a lot of the risk that was embedded in the system actually arose before Basel II began. Quite possibly Basel II might not have addressed that adequately enough once it came in, but Basel I was the set of rules that most people are operating under. The US is still under it, in fact. But a couple of other points, I suppose. Any set of regulations will engender a certain degree of incentive to avoid them, and the Basel rules are no exception, and a lot of the risk that we saw come into the system actually came via channels which had really been established to avoid regulatory capital, or at least lessen regulatory capital arrangements. So I think in our future efforts to adjust these regulatory systems, we need to keep that incentive in mind. The harder we regulate, in a sense, the more incentive there is for the activity to pop up outside the regulatory net in the future. The second observation I would make is that most countries were operating under Basel rules, but some countries had problems and some had much less problems. So to my mind, that has to mean that the way the rules were applied matters just as much as the rules themselves. And I think, there were some countries, and I think we would immodestly perhaps include ourselves here, where the supervisors arguably did a better job of applying the given set of rules that the whole world was operating on than the supervisors in some other countries did. So I would offer those perspectives, I think.
Jim, from a Treasury's perspective, how have you seen Basel operate? What's been your view on some of the comments that Hans made about its adequacy and so on?
Hans raised issues which I think are probably the solution to the answers. There are general things that we're all aware about: better accountability and maybe improved governance. And I think what you've seen coming out of the global financial crisis, a more coordinated global approach to regulation, and that led by the G20, which I think is a very good thing, and Treasury's view is a very good thing, that has become the big international body for regulation and other economic matters. And you've got now the Financial Stability Board in a much more, in my view, a more dominant position, and to oversight the work of the Basel Committee, IOSCO, the insurance regulators, and to some extent the IMF and the World Bank in this space. So I think those new arrangements will lead to probably maybe better calibrated regulatory requirements for banks. I mean, everyone's learned from past experiences. I agree it oftentimes is not so much the rules, which we found very much in Australia, and not even the most recent global financial crisis, but before we've had rules and they weren't enforced by the regulators weren't resourced, and that made a hell of a difference. So I think Basel, yes, things could be improved with Basel, and I think the work they're doing now will more fine-tune the rules for banking in light of the past experiences. So I'm quite positive about the work of Basel.
John, thanks for joining us. I'm sorry you were delayed. You missed some controversial comments about the Basel Committee, so I thought I'd preface the question by saying that. But what's... you've worked closely with the Basel Committee, you're heavily involved with. What's been your... One of the comments that Hans made was he likened them to the credit rating... likened the committee to the credit rating agencies when you look at the problems that occurred and its responsibilities. He questioned whether it was a politicised process that Basel Committee went through. So some interesting comments. What's your experience with the Basel Committee?
Well, our experience, Tony, and members of the ASIC Summer School, is a limited one in one sense, that we've only been a member of the Basel Committee since our first meeting in July last year. We invited to join in May last year, and it's been a fascinating experience. Herding sheep is really the simplest way I could describe it. To try and get compromise amongst quite different country groupings, within country groupings, getting an agreed position is complicated. That's particularly the case in Europe. The divide between the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere is quite clear now because many of our countries have done well through the crisis. Many of the Northern Hemisphere countries have not. So there's a lot of work still to be done to try and forge a consensus. There's a lot of work going on behind the scenes at the moment called the Quantitative Impact Study, which will try and put flesh on the bones of these principles that Basel has enunciated. That's quite important work, and it's quite complicated work. The data hasn't even come in yet, so it won't be until the middle of this year that we get a sense of how these proposals will actually work, given where banks are starting from. It'll take to the end of this year, really, to resolve a Basel Committee position and then time to implement that. So all I can see ahead of me at the moment is just a lot of hard work and strong pressure coming from the political process to get this work done on a very tight timetable. That's where the political pressure is the strongest. It's really coming out of the G20 saying that there are fundamental fissures and cracks in the financial system and they've got to be addressed quickly. They've got to be addressed in a way that promotes a resilient and strong foundation, and before inertia and resistance starts to build up.
Thanks, John. Jane, do you want to... contrasting that to IOSCO and your work you're doing there, are some of the descriptions that about the Basel Committee all that different for other international organisations? But what's your view on what Hans has said?
As Hans was speaking, I was, of course, thinking of the IOSCO comparison. And... I think some of the challenges the Basel Committee faces, IOSCO faces as well. The issue of consensus decision-making is a difficult one, and one that I actually had a little debate last night with an ASIC commissioner about. And the trade-off and the difficulty is if you actually want universal implementation and acceptance, so you want... For example, you want the US and the UK and the European countries and Australia and New Zealand to all be comfortable to adopt a standard, then you do have to at least have an agreed process, even if it's not absolute universality. Obviously, a complete consensus means a veto by any one nation, and that in itself can be very difficult. Because you run the risk of deteriorating to the lowest standard that's acceptable to anybody. I think the way that IOSCO tends to work in practice is that we have set aspirational standards and we all hope to be able to get to them. And therefore, you don't necessarily have to be able to implement it today in your jurisdiction. Now, that is changing as we become more operational. And we are now looking at actually setting standards for the business, for credit rating agencies, for actual business people active in the business of financial regulation in a very direct sense. And that's actually becoming more difficult. And what we're finding is even if we set a standard which might start off being aspirational, the actual implementation of that standard may vary. And that causes problems both for the market participants, and we can see there's a lot of noise from credit rating agencies at the moment, and it also causes, I think, some difficulties in the actual setting of the standard. So these issues are not solely matters of concern for the Basel Committee. Having said that, one of the differences we have with IOSCO is that IOSCO is representative of over 95% of the capital markets, and each country has each securities market regulator has a representative at IOSCO. That's not the case for the Basel Committee, and I think that perhaps sets a different set of challenges for the Basel Committee than for IOSCO.
Just before moving to, I want to come back to leverage ratios and governance, too big to fail, a little bit later. Just one more comment from you, Hans. I mean, the reality is, though, wouldn't I be right in saying that the way that these institutions, the FSB, Basel, IOSCO, IASB, and the other international bodies have responded to the crisis, wouldn't that give you some comfort that this time around they're actually, despite the politicisation, despite the limitations on consensus, there's actually a significant move afoot to achieve change?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting to note that countries that were not part of the Basel Committee did best, like India and Australia.
I see I didn't get you away from that comment.
And secondly, yes, there is a lot of political impetus right now to do the right thing. But I'm very... you were not there, but I quoted Nout Welling as stating in Dutch Parliament that he was very worried for political pushback and banking pushback against strict rules. And I'm very worried about that. I know that several European countries who have huge universal banks with huge balance sheets are pushing back very much against a leverage ratio, which I think is absolutely essential. I know that there are European countries which have still so many problems in their banking sector that they are not at the forefront of making all that visible, which is also a reason why there's a lot of pressure from the prudential community to the international accounting standard setters, which is something, I mean, my speech was also a bit born out of worry about that, out of concern about that pressure that is being put on the accountancy standing setters. So, I mean, it's very clear that, if anything, the current accounting standards did not show the problems sufficiently in time, and there's absolutely no reason to go for a softening of accounting standard setters. Rather, they should be made more stringent. I'm still very concerned that... as the banks recover gradually, that the problems that were there and are still there, that they will be forgotten and that we will go back to business as usual. I find it very disappointing that there is so little support for the ideas of Paul Volcker. In Europe, they have basically already said, at first instance, the French said, for political reasons, that they supported it. They are very much busy ditching it in practice. And I gave a couple of, I think, very valid conduct of business reasons why this has to be looked at very closely. I don't think it's going to be done. So... although I'm generally rather optimistic by nature, in this particular instance, I'm not.
We'll come back, as I said, to some of these issues, the work of the FSB, too big to fail. I just want to come to Australia at the moment, because you quite kindly said that we have fared much better and it's one of the countries to look at. So let's look at that. Is it right that we've done much better, and why? And to get the panel on those issues. Perhaps, John, we'll start with you. The notion that we have fared much better, is that right, and why is it? What are the things?
Well, I think the general consensus is that we have done well through the crisis, both in terms of the performance of the economy and the strength of our banking system. Glenn is better placed than me to talk about the macroeconomic influences, but I've summarised them in other articles as very deft handling of monetary policy, aggressive monetary policy, targeted fiscal stimulus, the recovery of our Asian export markets. And beneath that, though, has been the underlying strength of the banking system, which meant that it was in a position to support growth, and it did that without any government equity injections. And behind that, and it's harder for me to speak because I'm the beholder, but I think our regulatory system worked well. And there are two elements to that. One is that the rules, I think Glenn made this point when we came in, the rules that we implemented in Australia were global rules. That was the Basel II framework. We implemented it. It's done the heavy lifting for us. It's done what it was asked to do. It didn't cover all of the risks, and that's why we've got more work to do. And the second element is the effectiveness of our own supervision, which I say others can judge, but we've been very focused and very intensive all the way through this period, but beforehand. We did our hard work before the crisis started. So, I mean, I'm open-minded about global reform. We live and have lived in the banking system in Australia with a global regime. Where we've had some discretion to implement it, we've made sure it made sense in the way it was implemented in Australia, and where there was discretion on the quality of capital, we always took the conservative approach. The depositors. Other jurisdictions didn't take as conservative an approach. What that means is that when the new rules on capital quality come out, they will be, we think, closer to where we've already been, which means that the impact on the banking system on the capital side in Australia is going to be much less demanding, if demanding at all, than it will be in other jurisdictions.
Can you give some examples of that and just expand it a bit for the audience?
We've taken a view that predominant form of quality capital is equity and retained earnings. We like genuine shareholders skin in the game. And we tightened up in 2005, 2006 to make that a much more important part of capital and place less emphasis on the heavily engineered so-called Tier 2 innovative capital. And we took a pretty strict approach to what you couldn't count in capital. And others took a less strict approach for other reasons. And that will be harmonised through the Basel process. And I think, as I said elsewhere, we'll be keeping more company by having been conservative on capital. But it does mean our banks go into the reform process, in a sense, having done some of the hard yards anyway.
Jim, you've had a few sleepless nights the last little while in terms of where Treasury...
Only Jim.
In terms of where Treasury sits, what's your view in terms of how well we've fared and what comfort level you have in going forward that our system is going to continue to really stand up?
Well, I think there's a combination of factors why Australia fared well through the crisis, and I suppose I repeat John's comments and monetary fiscal policy, all these other factors have played very much into the hands. But I'd go back a step and I'd say that it's because at a government policy level, regulation of financial markets, securities markets, corporate governance over the last 25 years has been a very important matter for the Australian government. For every government I've worked for, it's always been the responsibility of a senior minister. They've always been interested and aware of not only how the markets are operating, but also how the regulators are conducting their responsibilities. In Australia, for Hans' this comment, it's always been a major issue about who leads the organisations, who leads the regulators. It's always been a major issue of government to get the best people possible. So government's been involved, not too much involved, but always had an oversight view of how financial markets, the regulations going. So I think that's actually stood Australia in very good stead. And so when you had the stress of Australians coming this time around, we were well positioned. Now, there's always a bit of good fortune in these things, but to some extent you make your own good fortune. Now, we had the collapse of, everyone of you here will remember, a major insurance company in 2002, HIH, which was the biggest general insurer. We had that. We had a housing bubble in 01 and 02, which was managed. So we've had our strains, but we've sort of learnt lessons from that, revamped regulatory structures, improved regulation. So all along, over, a little booms and busts, which you always have in financial markets, we've sort of come out of each one of those and re-looked at our system, enhanced it where we needed to. So overall, that said, Australia is not, and this is why it's so important, the work that's been going on in the G20, in the Basel Committee, in IOSCA. We are a medium-sized economy. We are placed in the world, in an international world, in a global financial markets. And I think that came out clearly when we had to introduce the wholesale funding guarantees for our banks. Now, our banks were very well capitalised and very resilient and very well placed, but we still, the government still had to introduce a wholesale funding guarantee. And that's because of the international dimension of it. So, all things, we're very well placed, but it's hardly the time to be sanguine about these issues. It's the time to be really on your game and be seeking to get the best international regulatory framework possible and for Australia's regulatory framework to be fit within that international framework.
Glenn, your observations. Also, I guess, comment a bit, I mean, we had issues with state banks and HIH, I guess the extent to which that added to being able to strengthen our system for what's occurred. But your view on how we fared better and more?
Well, most of what needs to be said has been said, I think, by John and Jim. We might allow some scope for the banks, particularly the major institutions, I think, having been pretty well managed themselves, no doubt under John's tutelage, of course. But I think that matters. Yep. And I think also... a long, reasonably steady macroeconomic environment at home that actually provided plenty of growth opportunities for the financial sector. You didn't have to go and do exotic things in foreign markets, the way maybe some European banks felt more pressure to do because natural growth in Europe is less. Here, there's plenty of natural growth at home doing plain vanilla things. And... So that environment, I think, was helpful. And, of course, these things are mutually reinforcing. A stable macroeconomy helps the banking system, but vice versa is also true. I would agree, I think, that setbacks that came in previous years, HIH, is one, and various other things that have occurred. All those things are lessons that one also should very carefully examine and make adjustments as necessary to the regulatory and policy setup. And if we're smart, we will do the same thing out of this recent episode, despite the fact that we have come through better than most. It probably wouldn't hurt for there to be a little bit more capital and more attention to liquidity, and more attention paid to the possibility that important funding markets that banks rely on can seize up, and that's got to be remembered when they're managing their businesses. So all these things are, I think, useful things for us to learn. Despite the fact that the economy overall has come through pretty well so far.
Jane, just taking your New Zealand, putting your New Zealand hat on as opposed to your IOSCO hat, What's been the experience with New Zealand? And I mean, it's done reasonably well as well throughout this.
It has, Tony. I think we have the benefit, of course, of our banking system being largely the Australian banking system. So we obviously have the strength of the Australian banks that have been, has been discussed earlier by John and Glenn. And I think that's stood New Zealand in good stead as well. We have had problems with the credit channel and the fact that small to medium-sized businesses have found it difficult to access capital, and that's been not assisted by the fact that the finance company sector in New Zealand collapsed and reduced the access to mezzanine finance, and there's been some difficulty in that area. But the New Zealand economy is strong as well, and certainly our major exports have held up. So I think we've had the benefit to some extent of a well-regulated banking system as well.
And Hans, you mentioned that the Netherlands has a Twin Peaks model as well, and we've been just going through the virtues and the way that the Australian system has stood up. What's when you hear that and you contrast it to what happened in the Netherlands, what have been the things that have occurred there that haven't occurred here?
Well, first of all, it goes to show that Twin Peaks is not a guarantee for complete success. Yeah. Huh? Secondly, I would truly congratulate the Australians with their regulatory competence, because you guys did a really good job. And perhaps you were a bit lucky that you had a minor housing crisis beforehand. It's very interesting to see that most countries that did well had a recent experience with a banking crisis in the past years. Most Asian countries did well, and also Australia. And furthermore, you were very lucky to be very close to Asia and to be very far away from the United States. that also helps. But I would say it's more competence than luck. Why didn't things go as well in the Netherlands? I think it has a lot to do with the introduction of, there we go again, Basel II, which allowed banks to tremendously reduce the risk weights for mortgage lending. And the Dutch banks are heavily engaged in mortgage lending. And one of the things that happened is that many of the Dutch banks levered up, because their capital requirements were actually lowered by Basel II. And quite frankly, I think we did not look beyond the numbers. And we are paying a very heavy price for it.
The next subject I want to move to, but before I do, I'm going to ask any questions from the floor at this stage. I want to move to, just given how well we've done in Australia, to really talk to the panel about whether we should be doing anything and the extent to which we should be participating in a lot of the reforms that are going on and then leading into leverage and so on. But before doing that, are there questions, a couple of questions from the floor I'd like to pose to the panel? No questions? Okay.
We're being too clear, I'm afraid.
I think. I'm sure they'll warm up as the day goes by. If we then move to the reforms themselves, given how well we've done, I guess, goes back, Glenn, starting with you, does Australia really need to do very much?
Well, I think I would preface my remarks by saying that a country like ourselves, I don't think can feasibly expect to either stand aside completely from the way international standards evolve. You can't, because, as Jim said, we're part of a global system. And secondly, yes, we're now have a seat at the table. It turns out it's a very big table, actually. The FSB, which I participate in, is 70 people around the table. Basel Committee is, I'm not sure how big that is, but it's, you know, these are big groups now.
40.
We're one voice, and we have the opportunity to put our points and have some marginal effects on the outcome, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that we are going to outweigh what is still actually a very dominant weight of the G7, really. With those caveats, I think that our interests are in making a contribution to the extent we can to the shaping of sensible international regulations. I fully endorse what John said about the need for the quantitative impact work to be done very carefully, to be allowed adequate time to be completed. The last thing we want is a rush to some ill-considered set of arrangements that have not been fully thought through. So that work needs to be done carefully. Certainly there shouldn't be any delay, but it does take a bit of time, so that time has to be granted. I frankly think myself that it's likely that a sensibly applied leverage ratio, I don't really think we need it, but it won't do any great harm to Australia, provided it's calibrated sensibly. I think on issues of quantity and quality of capital, as John said, we're probably already doing well anyway, so that will be at the margin. Liquidity is going to be the issue where we will need careful... we will need the ability to tailor the set of principles in a way that works in Australia, and everybody knows what the issues are here. There's not enough government debt to literally hold as much as the draft principles that were put out would require. So we're going to have a solution that works on some other set of devices, unless we want our governments to run very much larger deficits and get that debt up, which, of course, for other reasons, we may not. So...
And government debt is not necessarily liquid in these days.
In fact, I think a lesson of the crisis is that lots of things that you thought were liquid are not liquid when markets seize. So markets can have these seizures. And, you don't solve that by just mandating to banks hold more of this particular instrument. So I think I wouldn't say that we need to do nothing. It would be foolish to think that everything's just peachy here. I think there are things for us to learn, adjustments we can make, but we need to do that in a thoughtful way, and what we really want is an adequate amount of flexibility at the national level to adhere to the spirit and the intention of the new rules in a way that in practice works for us.
John, you've come under... some pressure from banks saying, well, really, we've done very well. Why do we need any change at all? What's your take on what's happening internationally and the impact here for you?
I do get counseled by boards and chief executives along those lines. Not to follow blindly, I think, was one of the phrases that was used. I don't know how many of you are from this particular state, but there is a strange code of football played down in Melbourne called AFL. And if you think of that as a metaphor for what's happening in the global regulatory environment, what's very important with that game is that the players have a set of qualities which enable them to compete in that game. We've got to be fit, got to be fast, helps to be tall, but it fundamentally helps to be very strong because it's a contact sport. And that's our role as the prudential regulator, is to run our players onto this game fit and strong. Now, the global financial market is a bit like that. It's not a place for the faint-hearted. It requires all of the participants to be fit and strong. And that was the failing through the course of 2008-2009, that a lot of the stronger players really were unfit and they were certainly weak. But when the Australians run onto this field, they can't run on and say, well, I've got the Australian coat of arms on my jersey, so I'm allowed to run 50 metres before anyone can tackle me because I did really well in the crisis. And I can take a second shot at goal if I miss the first one. Now, the world doesn't work like that. You know, we will be judged by global markets on the same standards as everybody else. And as Jim said, the fact was that even though our banks were well capitalised and well rated, AA rated, the top four, in a very small group of 8 or 9 players, they still found it very difficult to raise funds when those markets froze. So Glenn's right. What we need is a set of global rules which are sensible. Not extreme, not targeted at extreme problems, but a sensible set of rules within which we can operate, which assure funding is available to strong players in the marketplace. Australian banks need strong counterparties, otherwise there's no funding. And that's why it's a global effort, and that's why we're part of it, seeking to make sure it makes sense when it works in Australia. As Glenn said, we've got a couple of unique issues to deal with because we've got very prudent governments, but we'll work through that.
We've been focusing on the, I guess, more prudential. We might go to securities and investment, perhaps with Jim and Jane. Jane, in terms of the IOSCO's agenda on securities regulation, it seems to have a reasonably long list. Could you give us a bit of an update on that? And I'll ask Jim to comment about the impact of those sorts of changes on what is a very strong regulatory system that we have in Australia already.
Thanks, Tony. I think the learnings from the global financial crisis are multifarious, and we've heard some of them this morning. But one of the things that's emerged, I think, very clearly, if anyone thought that markets weren't interconnected, that's clearly wrong. The concept that markets would automatically, as a matter of self-interest, regulate themselves or correct themselves has been found to be wanting. And I think, too, something that the orthodoxy, which had been abroad, that fundamentally market stability was only a matter really for institutions and not for markets, is, I believe, also being challenged quite significantly. And IOSCO has, as part of its response to the global financial crisis, developed, or is in the process of developing, a new principle on systemic risk in markets. And in a way, the reflection of the Twin Peaks model is the mirror of that is the what I would call the virtuous twins of stability, which is both that institutions matter and markets matter. You can have the most perfectly regulated institution, but if the markets are haywire, that institution cannot function appropriately. And similarly, if you have well-regulated markets but poorly regulated institutions, you're going to have a problem. So I think these the twin peaks of market regulation and prudential regulation is mirrored in the ideas of financial stability as well. And that's certainly one of the major thrusts of IOSCO's new principle. And we're trying to articulate that in a way which has practical implications for securities markets regulators. So looking at securities markets regulators having greater research capacity to try and identify discontinuities in market behaviour which may need addressing, to look at over the fence of the regulatory boundaries at the moment, and to look out and to see whether there are developments outside the current regulatory fence which may threaten the stability of the regulated markets. Now, I can remember being at a financial stability forum a number of years ago where one of our colleagues in the securities markets regulatory world, I think it was Andrew Sheng actually, tried to challenge the idea that beyond the current regulatory space there might be issues that could affect financial stability. And he was completely put down by some members of the US Fed at the time who almost mocked the idea that there was any question that markets themselves might have a stability impact. And I think that that is one of the learnings out of the global financial crisis. And if I could just say, IOSCO has actually published 20-plus reports, some of which look over the fence, some of which are trying to actually identify issues that might affect market stability, and some of which they've worked with the Basel Committee and the IAS through the joint forum, which Tony, you chair, which have been actually focusing on cross-border supervision, for example, another important issue in trying to identify and work on market stability issues. So Tony, there's a huge body of work that IOSCO has undertaken. I won't give this audience the full list, but if they look at the IOSCO website, they can see it. And it is really directed to trying to have a look at the learnings out of the global financial crisis and address them in a very practical way.
And Jim is an avid reader of the IOSCO website, I know. Jim, we've seen, I guess, the reforms that have come through so far that have been related to that have been around short selling, around credit rating agencies. Mm. Credit rating agencies. But what, looking forward, what do you see coming out of some of the IOSCO work that will be relevant to our regulatory system? I'm not suggesting that you're announcing policy, but the sorts of issues that we may need to consider further as a country.
Well, I think in the conduct and disclosure area, it is sort of question marks being asked as to whether the basic assumptions for the regulatory framework are the right assumptions. And you've got questions about the efficient market thesis. You've got questions about whether people, especially at the retail end, can ever come to grips with some of the sophistication of certain financial products. In Australia, we've got an ageing population, we've got a retirement incomes policy which leads to a lot of people's savings going into superannuation and other investment products. So I think we're in a position where it very much behoves the government and the regulators to have in place proper arrangements to ensure that risk is minimised to the greatest extent, especially risk which could impact on retail investors. So I think some of the work on the conduct and disclosure work is very important. It's on prudential regulation, you can sort of contain it to some extent and know clear who you're regulating, the institutions you're regulating. ASIC on the conduct and disclosure virtually regulates everything that's not regulated by APRA. It's a huge mandate. And when you think about it's regulating capital markets and also it's providing consumer protection to the financial sector, that is just a very wide mandate which needs to be effective for the regulator. You have to have, I think, some very clear rules, and probably you've got to also work on financial literacy education and those types of issues to upgrade the general public in terms of their better assessment of risk. I don't think you can do it through regulation, and I don't think you can do it through just putting more police on the beat for more resources for the regulator. It's got to be very much an educational thing as well.
Do you have a view how far, and this is a hard question, but how far we can go, and at what point of time you really have to let investors, particularly retail investors, take the consequence of investment decisions and wear losses? We've had quite a bit of criticism with the losses that have occurred at the retail investor level as to whether we could do more to prevent that.
Well, I think it's very difficult. I think they do take the losses at the present time. And you can have these events happen, and we have a parliamentary inquiry as to why it happened, and people are wrapped over the knuckles, and then we're called upon to tighten up the regulatory framework, or say margin lending, but is that really going to be an effective response? You're continually coming after the event. So I think it's really precious, not pressure, but I mean the real issue for ASIC is to be innovative with the resources it's given to ensure, to try to the greatest extent provide the best regulatory approach or framework it can for the general public. I think it's a time to be thinking about what you're doing, actually.
Just there's one comment from the floor, or asking the panel to comment on, and it reads this way: comment on bank regulation, noting the concerns of large sovereign debt, and for example, PIIGS. I'm not sure what that is myself.
Pigs.
Is that? Yeah, no, I didn't want to. Okay, it's pigs. Okay. And nationalisation of some European banks.
Can I say something about that?
Hans.
Well, I'm not in a position to give any advice to Australia, but if I were forced to do so...
Please do.
What I would tell you is, please continue to be more conservative than the rest of the world. And secondly, prepare for a very difficult economic time, which you will not be able to continue to escape. In Europe and in the United States, we didn't solve many of the problems. We merely replaced them from the banks to the governments. All major, almost all major European governments are going in the Italian direction. We used to mock Italy for having a government debt of 100% of GDP or more. Many European countries are going that way. United States is going that way. We have horrible budget deficits, which are even more horrible than in the 70s. We have very weird ideas coming into existence. IMF wondering if central banks should not go for inflation targets of 4%. I mean, we are going back to the 60s and the 70s, except that the budgetary problems are even bigger. And this is going to take a tremendous toll on the world economy for a long time to come, and Australia will not be able to escape that. I'm absolutely sure of that, because I don't think that Asia, China can completely compensate for all the problems in the Western world. So all I can say is you're not complacent, but success always has the danger of leading to complacency. Don't become complacent and continue to be as vigilant as you have been.
Any other comments from other panel members?
Well, the fiscal challenges that are faced in Europe, UK, US, let's not forget Japan. We've been facing it for 15 years, and actually they still haven't had the inflation that you might have expected that might result from.
Who can explain that to me?
My explanation is they're the exception that proves the rule. But these challenges are immense. And the challenge for those countries is to articulate a short-term path that allows them not to knock the still rather hesitant economic recovery on the head, but does chart a path back to long-run sustainability. And that is going to be very, very difficult indeed. From our point of view, of course, these things present as risks to the economic outlook for the major countries. But another perspective to keep in mind is, and I've said this all through this past couple of years, we can come out of this episode as the country that didn't have to buy their banks, where government finances are in terrific shape, really. You know, the debt ratio will peak at 10, probably, percent of GDP. Strong regulatory framework. Didn't have to do very unconventional monetary or fiscal measures. The regular measures applied liberally worked a treat, actually. We remain open for business, plugged into the part of the world where all the growth is. So, yeah, it's not Pollyanna-ish, you know, everything's rosy, but, how many other countries are on that list? Not many.
Sort of almost a sort of point where I should stop, I think, but I'll see.
The music starts.
I understand exactly the sentiments. I sort of go back to a couple of issues that we'll finish off on too big to fail and leverage. On too big to fail, the debate, so-called Volcker rule, the announcement that President Obama made, I guess, and Hans made these points, but looking at perhaps Glenn and John, I mean, what is this about, this too big to fail issue, and really, what What do you see? Do you see any real potential impact in for Australia?
Tony, I think the question's often phrased these days not only as too big to fail, but too interconnected to fail, and it's unravelling the linkages between institutions which the Learmonth case revealed. That's where the complexity became an issue. And we know that there are solutions that are being discussed in global fora and being put forward on the political agenda. You either narrow the range of activities that these large institutions can undertake, or you have a higher capital charge, or you have more intense supervision, or some combination of the three. And the fact that there are no clear answers is an indication of just how complex that set of questions is. Even going to the very question, which institutions do you deem to be too big or too interconnected to fail? And very, very few countries would actually nominate those. And I think if they had, they probably wouldn't have picked up a Northern Rock 2 years ago. Yeah. I think in our case, we've always applied a more intense scrutiny of our larger institutions. And we have a risk rating process which really forces us to do. It's talked in the direction of intervening more intensely and more quickly if the institution is likely to have a systemic impact. So we do that. That's our day job, and I think that will still be part of any solution, is that we will just be breathing down the neck of larger institutions much more regularly than we would of a smaller institution. It's, you know, it's almost as simple as that.
And Glenn, how much of it is a political issue and a regulatory issue in the sense that you could come up with concepts of what too big is or what systemic is, but at the end of the day, when you have a Northern Rock, assuming it's not in the systemic category or it's not in the too big to fail category, is this more of a political issue, or is it an issue that the regulators can continue to work on?
Well, I think in time of crisis, it gets harder to judge ex ante who's systemic and who isn't. And I think the bar to be labelled systemic goes down. The bigger the crisis is, the lower that bar gets. And it then becomes a rather courageous regulator who recommends, yes, Minister Entity X, you should just let it fail. And an even more courageous minister who may be wary to accept that advice. So in a time of crisis, particularly a really big one, these things are very hard. If you have an idiosyncratic failure of a minor entity out of the clear blue sky and nothing else is going wrong, then it's much easier to say, well, there are resolution procedures for these entities. That's why we have the financial claims scheme now. And the market processes would take their course. So it tends to be, I think, unavoidably context specific when you're reaching these judgments. And I think that's just the nature of things. And a government is always going to have to ultimately be involved, I think, when there's an institution of any size. And the question is, do we save it or do we let it fail? I can't see how, if it's tiny, sure, that's different. But anything of any significant size at all, there's ultimately going to be a government having to make a decision there whether to rescue it or not.
And Hans, you're a proponent of really coming up with rules on too big to fail. How do you see it playing out at the FSB level?
Well, I really have to confess I'm not an expert on the issue. All I know is that it is, in the long run, totally unacceptable that a private company or a company that cannot be allowed to fail has no business being in the private sector. So if we don't solve this issue, we will end up with a nationalized banking sector, such as we have in many parts of the world at this moment. So it needs to be solved. And all I have said, there is no silver bullet for this issue, because it's very complicated. And in many ways, it might be as simple as being much more on top of your big institutions. The opposite happened in the United States and in Europe. they were left to their own devices. They were allowed to do their own risk management or to do their own risk assessment. And basically, the central bankers kept a lot of distance from them. There is no silver bullet. You'll have to do a lot of things to address this issue. I think that Paul Volcker has delivered a couple of suggestions which make a lot of sense, not only from the point of view from too big to fail, but also from the point of view from conduct of business. I mean, it is simply unacceptable that an investment bank goes out selling CDOs to the market to so-called sophisticated investors, while at the same time they are covering their own behind for those same instruments. We cannot allow that to happen in the future. So I think there is a very good case, also from the point of view of conduct of business regulation, I think if you would basically say everywhere where we need Chinese walls now, let's accept that Chinese walls are not enough, and let's split up these sort of activities. And that would go a long way to addressing this problem. On top of extra capital requirements, on top of extra liquidity requirements, a whole array of things have to be done.
I mean, there's a few things happening here, right? There's Volcker or Volcker-like ideas of separating activities. There's all the things to get more instruments under CCPs so that when someone falls over, there's more insulation. And then there's more intense supervision on the larger entities on top of the capital things. I suppose the more controversial things that are talked about are, you know, a systemic risk charge if you're big on top of all that, which, you know, perhaps that's a good idea. And then there's the living will stuff. Maybe these good ideas. I suppose from a policy point of view, yes, you're absolutely right. A world in which the losses are socialised and the profits are privatised, obviously, you know, it's not sustainable. But there is at least an argument, in principle, it seems to me, for financial institutions to some extent at least, to have global reach for the same reasons that other non-financial institutions have global reach. There are certain efficiencies there. So can we reap those while addressing these other concerns, or is that impossible? I mean, that's the thing, you know, in which case we'd have to choose. And it seems to me we're groping in the international regulatory community towards those questions without knowing which way the answer is going to go.
This living will stuff. Have you ever heard about dead people making wills? why are they called living wills?
Yeah. It's a good question I've asked myself. Most of us write our will while we're still alive, if we're sensible. But if we don't, then it's much more complicated for our estate if we haven't written a will. So maybe the lesson is...
It's to make people start to plan as to how they would...
Well, I think those things are useful if the process of drawing up your own wind down and showing it to the regulators brings out how complex the structure is, and then the regulator says, hey, hang on,
that's right.
I want some more simplicity.
No, I think it makes perfect sense. I just don't understand why they're called
the
living wills.
Okay, we're out of time, so I'm going to wrap it up here and to ask you to join with me in thanking our panel. We have in this session been clearly concentrating more with the calibre of the panel on more prudential issues. The next session will be more on the securities and investment issues, but certainly can I, on behalf of everyone, thank each of you, and Hans in particular, for fantastic comments, full, free and frank, and that's what we wanted, so thank you.